Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. News.
The Czech authorities repatriated more than 5,000 nationals from different parts of the world in the past 3 weeks. A blanket screening of selected parts of the population for the COVID-19 virus is being launched this week to ascertain the spread of the infection. And as of today, Czechs may travel abroad, but only for substantiated reasons. In the last 3 weeks, the Czech Republic repatriated more than 5,000 Czech nationals stranded abroad due to the coronavirus crisis, Czech Radio reported, citing foreign ministry sources. 2,800 people were repatriated on special flights, 2,400 by road. In cooperation with EU partners, the Czech authorities also helped 700 citizens of EU member states to return home. The Czech government released more than 100 million crowns for the repatriation effort, with the ministry contributing 700 euro to the cost of the return trip for each passenger. A blanket screening of selected parts of the population for the COVID-19 virus is being launched this week to ascertain how many individuals have undergone the disease without showing any symptoms. The screening will be undertaken with the help of so-called rapid tests based on detecting antibodies to the virus in people's blood samples. The tests are to be conducted on several hundred people of all ages. The results should give the health authorities valuable information regarding the degree of herd immunity achieved and is likely to influence the speed with which the government restrictions will be eased. As of today, April 14th, Czechs may travel abroad, but only in exceptional cases and for substantiated reasons. According to a government regulation, people will be allowed to leave the country for business reasons to see a doctor or close family on urgent matters. They will be registered and will have to undergo a standard 14-day quarantine upon their return. However, in view of the international situation, borders remain closed and foreigners are still banned from entering the country. Details of the new regulation can be found on the Interior Ministry's website. The number of people with confirmed coronavirus infection reached 6,059 on Tuesday morning, according to data released by the Czech Ministry of Health. The number of people registered COVID-19 positive rose by 68 on Monday, the smallest daily increase since March 17th, when 67 new cases were registered. 147 deaths are reported. Meanwhile, 519 people have fully recovered from COVID-19. Czech labs have tested over 130,000 people to date. Schools are unlikely to reopen for all students by the end of June, the country's leading epidemiologist Roman Primula said in an interview for the news site Seznam.cz. Primula said it was likely that pupils from higher classes, especially those facing secondary school or university entrance exams, would return sooner, but younger children would most likely be kept out of the classroom until the new school year. The country's chief hygiene officer, Jarmila Rajová, expressed a similar view in an interview for Czech Radio. The issue is to be debated at Tuesday's cabinet meeting within a broader debate on easing the coronavirus restrictions. Car manufacturer Hyundai in Nošovice in Frýdek Místek is resuming production on Tuesday after a 3-week break due to the coronavirus pandemic. It is the first large company in the country to do so. According to the company's spokesman, it will initially operate on 2 shifts instead of the usual 3 and adhere to strict hygiene norms. In order to ensure a smooth start, the company is reported to have stocked up on car parts, contrary to the standard practice of producing vehicles just in time, according to customer demand. And finally, a quick look at the weather forecast. Wednesday should be clear to partly cloudy with more clouds in the eastern parts of the country and day temperatures between 13 and 17 degrees Celsius. I'm Daniela Lazarová, and that's the end of the news.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. Coming up in today's programme, we speak to one of the government's economic advisers about how the coronavirus epidemic could help speed up much-needed state digitisation. We talk to one of the volunteers who has been supplying much-needed face masks to Czech nursing homes. And later, we look in depth at how the recent row over the removal of a statue of Soviet Marshal Ivan Konev in Prague is an example of the complexity of memorizing past tragic events. All that coming up, so please stay with us. European states are facing economic interventions unprecedented since the Second World War, says Danuše Nerudová, currently a member of a special economic advisory team to the government's COVID-19 task force. The Economist believes this is a major opportunity to speed up much-needed reforms. When we spoke, she explained how the Czech Republic could harness such change to move away from its image as a fitting shop economy focused on assembling products such as cars.
Crisis can be a momentum for changing the direction, and we are currently in the Czech Republic in that momentum. Czech Republic is kind of a fitting shop of Europe, and this crisis creates a space to concentrate on production of products with higher value added. And I think it's also a space to redefine the investment strategies Czech Republic can invest into smart technologies. We can invest into the digitalization of public administration. And this is something which can move Czech economy from fitting shop to a different place.
I have to ask you this question because there's been talk about digitization for a long time. In fact, there was a big conference on digitization, if I am correct, last year. You know, how much is the government prepared to take these major steps?
Well, I think they are in the process because more than 2 or 3 weeks currently, like 80 or 90% of things went online. So I really do hope that they will stay online and they will really think strategically how to keep those agenda they needed to transfer online, how to invest into different instruments which might help to further digitalize public administration. I think this is the great opportunity because we are already half digitalized by the fact that even the government is not facing each other face-to-face. They are online. So even the ministries could be online. Even institutions are online. They are just communicating through the online instrument.
So in other words, you're basically saying that this sort of forced online communication, which we are witnessing right now, can be harnessed to speed up this digitization. Am I correct?
Yeah, and I would like to add that that it's necessary not to step back because we are already halfway. So we need to go ahead in the digitalization and take the crisis as the opportunity to finalize the process of digitalization.
I was talking to Danuše Nerudová there, who is currently a member of a special economic advisory team to the government's COVID-19 task force. Now, realizing around a month ago that Czech nursing homes were not receiving surgical masks or other materials needed to combat COVID-19, journalist Judita Matyášová began doing something about it. Under the name Roušky Seniorům, or Face Masks for Seniors, she and 36 other volunteers have now delivered around 20,000 to facilities across the country. Ian Willoughby discussed the initiative with Ms. Matyášová.
I started this activity a few days after emergency status, and it was not so easy for all people, especially for seniors, to find a place where they can get masks. So in those days, it wasn't so common as it is right now. So that was why I decided. And I knew that not only seniors, but also, of course, it's extremely important for people who work with seniors, because all the people who work with seniors, they travel back and forth to senior homes, and they didn't have masks yet.
But do they need better masks? Sorry to interrupt you, but do they need better ones than I need, for example, going to the shop?
For sure, staff, it would be the best situation. Then they need the plastic shield with a respirator. That would be the best. But in those days, they didn't have anything. And if they had something, it was very simple, one layer mask, not double with some filter.
But now you are sourcing for these homes masks that do have filters, is that right?
Yeah, 1 week or 10 days ago, we started cooperation with Technical University in Liberec. They have a special kind of filter, and then according their instructions, we send these instructions to the people who were creating masks for us. So they did it exactly. So then we can put it together, like filter and mask.
Some people listening to this may be thinking, surely these homes should be receiving masks and other materials from the state. What is the mood among clients and staff at nursing homes for seniors regarding how they are being treated by the state?
At the beginning, it was extremely desperate mood. I had around 80 or 100 calls every day. We cooperate with 40 senior homes and social care centres. And most of these places, they told me they need immediately at least 200 masks. And they were so desperate, they were almost crying. Then after, let's say, 1 week, now I'm talking about 20-something of March, the situation was a little bit changing. But the breaking point was the day when the first senior died. Suddenly, people of Czech Republic and media, suddenly they turned to this topic or group, and suddenly people started to be more and more interested. And that was the start of big boom of solidarity and help. It was very important, but somehow it was very late.
Journalist and volunteer Jurita Matyášová ending that interview by Ian Willoughby there. Just a reminder that you're listening to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio, where it's now time for our main feature of the day, the row over the recent removal of a statue of the Soviet Marshal Ivan Konev in Prague reminded us that the legacy of the recent past remains highly sensitive. Add to this the Russian-Polish debate over this month's 80th anniversary of the Katyn massacre, and you might be forgiven for thinking that the Second World War never really ended. David Vaughan spoke to the Swedish-based Czech historian Tomáš Snigoni, who has made a close study of Katyn and other sites of Stalinist atrocities in the former Soviet Union. The example of Katyn, he says, reminds us just how hard it is to memorialise the traumatic and complex legacy of the war and the period of Stalinism.
In April and May 1940, the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, ordered the mass murder of 22,000 Polish military officers and other representatives of Poland's elite. They'd been taken prisoner in autumn 1939, when the Soviet Union matched Germany's invasion of Poland from the west with its own invasion from the east. The mass graves of many of the victims in Katyn, near the western Russian city of Smolensk, were discovered by the Germans in 1943, during their invasion of the Soviet Union. They launched an investigation, which they used for their own propaganda purposes. Stalin promptly denied any connection with the massacre, and immediately Katyn became a propaganda battlefield. It also has a Czech connection, as research has shown that among the victims there were former Czechoslovak citizens, mainly from the ethnically mixed areas on the Czech-Polish borderlands. There were also two Czechs involved in the 1943 Nazi investigation. One was the pathologist František Hájek, sent as part of a German-led international delegation, and the other was the writer and poet František Kožík, who was sent to the site with other writers and journalists from across Nazi-occupied Europe. In a radio talk after his return, he described the scenes, including the sickly sweet smell of decomposing corpses. The Nazis calculated that such vivid accounts of Soviet atrocities would make people conclude that communism would be still worse than what they were experiencing under German occupation. Tomáš Snigoni began our interview by telling me that in the long run, this propaganda campaign proved totally counterproductive.
The fact that the Germans used the Katyn massacre in their propaganda helped actually the Soviets to deny it, because, of course, whatever after 1945, whatever was German was very questionable and was very negative. And that's why they could even start blaming Germans instead of themselves, because the crime was committed in April 1940. But according to the Soviet propaganda from the end of the war, so it was committed in 1941, after Nazi Germany started to occupy the Soviet territory, which means they wanted to claim that this was a German crime.
Which brings us to the question of how the site has been memorialized in both under communism, during the communist period, and then later under Gorbachev and after the fall of communism.
Up to the perestroika, it was really more or less, taboo in the Soviet bloc. But then during the perestroika, of course, the pressure was increasing, not only from Poland and from international community, but from the relatives and from the victims themselves within the Soviet Union. But thanks to the rather liberal attitude of Gorbachev, so the authorities did not stop this initiative.
In the course of the 1990s, there were plenty of signs, weren't there, that Russia and Poland were beginning to find a common language, a way of talking about Katyn that would be in some way acceptable to both sides. President Yeltsin also was part of that process. He visited Warsaw, the memorial to the victims of the Katyn massacre. It seemed as if there was a process of reconciliation going on, but that's changed, hasn't it?
Until 2010, there were indications that both countries were on the way to certain reconciliation. In 1996, a decent memorial started to be built in Katyn, and it was later the Polish part was declared as Polish military cemetery. And another important thing is that in Katyn particularly, together with more than 4,000 victims, there were also some Soviet victims of Stalinism, which were unknown. Before they started digging in the 1990s, before they started really to study the history of the place, so they didn't know too much about the Soviet victims of Stalinism, which were not victims of the Second World War or period after 1939, but the so-called Great Terror, 1937-38. And these people remained totally unknown. So in 1996, they started to build a decent memorial, and it lasted many years. But in 2010, this memorial, including both a Russian side and the Polish side, which was this military cemetery, were opened. First, the prime ministers of Russian Federation and Poland met in Katyn. At that time, it was Vladimir Putin and Donald Tusk. And then the presidents were supposed to meet in April 2010. And at that time, it was from the Russian side, Dmitry Medvedev, and from the Polish side, Lech Kaczynski. But what happened was that there was a terrible air crash. All the Polish delegation trying to land in Smolensk in bad weather were killed. And that's why it increased the tension, because some part of the Polish society started immediately to blame the Russians for their guilt in that accident, the tragedy.
And there wasn't any evidence for this, though, was there?
International investigations did not support that conspiracy theory. There were certainly some mistakes from a Russian side which are known, but there was a time factor. These people from Poland, especially the president, wanted to land in time. The weather was very bad, and that's why they wanted to attend the ceremony at any price, which unfortunately proved to be catastrophic, very sad.
And now, 10 years later, you've visited the site. Is there just no attempt to find a common narrative?
I have visited the site several times, and I'm still working with my research there. I would be skeptical about future hope and so on, even though it can quickly change if needed, because what is problematic are political attitudes, especially the attitude of the Russian leadership. Why? Because since the death of Lech Kaczynski, then Russia started a war against Ukraine and annexed Crimea in 2014. And also a new political party, Right Conservative Nationalist Party, came to power in Poland. So the will to compromise is very low, if any, at the moment. Also, Putin started to adjust the site of memory in Katyn to what I call patriotization of the Gulag memory, in order first to make it the site of Soviet suffering and therefore Russian suffering dominantly, not Polish suffering.
Russia has a particularly complex legacy, doesn't it, with its Stalinist past, because as a nation, it's both in the position of victim and perpetrator. So it is a very difficult legacy from which to draw some kind of, let's say, contemporary patriotic narrative.
Yes, at the same time, if you study these sites of memory, you see a certain difference between those sites where foreigners were martyred by the Stalinist regime and where Soviet citizens were martyred. Because, of course, if the victims were foreign, like in Katyn, then, of course, this process of dealing with the past is not only an internal issue of Russian Federation, it's an international affair, part of diplomacy, and therefore it's a weapon how to use the past against the other side. And now when we have in Poland since 2016, for example, the so-called law about decommunization, where symbols of the communist past are being removed, this has been equalized in Russia, and this challenged, you know, Russian self-perception, and that's why Katyn became a place of a kind of Russian revenge against Poland. They want to adjust the place in order to prove the Polish guilt in removing the symbols of the Soviet, so to say, liberation, even though it was not clear liberation for the Poles, of Poland by the Soviet Union in 1945.
The debate about Katyn is actually current in the Czech context, because we've had a recent debate about the removal just a few days ago of a statue of Marshal Konev, who was the Red Army general, the head of the army that liberated Prague in May 1945. But also he was later involved in the stamping down of the reforms in Hungary and the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. So a deeply ambivalent figure. But the statue that until a few days ago stood in Prague 6, was commemorating his role in the liberation of Prague in May 1945, which is undisputed.
It's an interesting process, because if you think about memorials, they are expressions of some current atmosphere in order to evaluate history, to choose which history is worth forgetting and which history is worth remembering. If you think about who built Soviet monuments in Prague and why, then they were different periods. There is a period 1945 to 48 where people were building these monuments in order to really genuinely express, rather freely still, express their gratitude to the Soviet army. You know, they were grateful for this kind of liberation. But that particular statue of Konev from 1980 was the expression of the so-called normalization. It was the period when Czechoslovakia was occupied by Soviet troops. They were not invited. It was legitimized later on. But it was a period when, again, these monuments were not expressing free will of people. So it is a very, very problematic period as well. So that's why I would also call for a little bit deeper research from the point of view of historian or memory scholars of this question.
You've given a lot of thought to how these traumatic events in history are memorialized. Do you have some kind of recipe for an approach which would enable us all to focus on the key issue, which is how can we avoid these tragedies happening again?
I don't have any recipe, unfortunately. If I had, I would be very happy. But on the other hand, you know, all these debates about memorials, all the debates about history are actually useful, I would say, because if they are at a certain level, I mean, if they are civilized and if they are focusing on arguments and if the sides of the conflict really think about each other's argumentation, they can contribute to the society's development and also to our understanding of our values and especially democratic values. And this historical culture of every society, it's a communicative process which never ends. We don't see any situation where you can say, I have finally came to terms with the past. So this is an ongoing process. And I think this pluralistic character is especially extremely important. We have to pay attention to details, to facts, and so on. But we have to also respect each other's arguments, which I think is a very, very positive in the long run.
And I think there's one other aspect, isn't there, which is to put focus on the victims, the fact that it isn't just numbers. That's often neglected, isn't it, that human side of the story?
Absolutely, because lack of empathy to individual victims sometimes develops into what I call a kind of morbid mathematics of victimization, you know, because, and now back to Katyn, for example, what happened there during the last years is that the Russian authorities suddenly made it, as I already mentioned, a place of predominantly Soviet suffering. Why? Because they now claim that in Katyn itself, the site of memory, there are 8,000 victims of Stalinism buried, but, so to say, in quotations marks, only 4,000 Poles. Earlier, it was a site connected with Polish suffering, without any doubt. Now they want to connect it with Soviet suffering and also Polish suffering. And therefore you have this mathematics. This is, however, not true, because these 8,000 people are not buried on the territory of Katyn Memorial, because these are victims of Stalinism from the entire area of Smolensk region, which means people murdered elsewhere, buried elsewhere, are also brought symbolically to Katyn in order to bead the memory of the Polish victims, so to say. And that's why you see this pragmatic, bureaucratic, and very emotionless attitude in order to achieve our political goals against them. History approached this way is always a mean of future conflict, not of reconciliation, not of understanding, and not of education towards something which will be more tolerant and more, say, democratic.
My thanks to Tomasz Sniegoń, who teaches at the University of Lund in Sweden.
David Vaughan there speaking to historian Tomasz Sniegoń about the difficulty of memorialising the traumatic and complex legacies of the Second World War and the period of Stalinism in Central Europe. If you have any comments about today's programme, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll certainly be glad to hear from you. But that's all for now. From me, Tom McEncrow, thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.